I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Scott Kelly is going to spend a year on the International Space Station with two Russian astronauts, making this the longest mission ever taken by a NASA astronaut. He returns in March 2016. NASA wants to learn about the impact of that much time in space on the human body to help plan for trips to Mars and beyond. Our guest Chris Impey says we are entering a new age of space travel, powered in large part by the private sector, by wealthy entrepreneurs, people like Elon Musk, Richard Branson, Jeff Bezos, Peter Diamandis. Impey's new book, Beyond, tells the history and the future of space exploration that includes things like space ladders and solar sails and robonauts and cyborgs. Chris Impey joins us on Radio Times. He's university distinguished professor and deputy head of the Department of Astronomy at the University of Arizona. His other books include How It Begins, How It Ends, and Humble Before the Void, which is about teaching science to Tibetan monks. Chris Impey, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, it's great to be back with you, Marty.
You know, I'm old enough to remember when Kennedy spoke about going into space, and we were, of course, in the throes of the Cold War, and he was rallying the country to go into space, in a sense, to beat the Soviets. What's behind, you think, this new urge or desire for space exploration?
Right. I mean, and what you're alluding to was a glorious time in the space program. Going to the moon was a fantastic achievement that we've not equaled, of course, for 45 years. But it was sort of aberrant history because it was based on the Cold War and this rivalry. So, and then I think we went through a doldrums. You know, we had the space shuttle, which was kind of an antique technology that retired 2 out of 5, destroyed catastrophically, didn't look very good. So I think this renaissance now is driven by something different. I mean, it's driven by economics, still driven by exploration and people who really are curious to see what happens when we move off Earth.
You say that NASA, perhaps in hindsight, should have thought about sending an artist or a poet into space. I was intrigued by that, but what's your thinking behind that?
I guess the thinking was it's when Christa McAuliffe died in the Challenger explosion that they essentially killed the idea of civilians, true civilians in space, and that's unfortunate. I think the thinking is it first came from talking to Pinky Nelson, one of the astronauts I've met who was at University of Washington when I was on sabbatical. And by the way, if you're an astronaut, you can be called Pinky and it's okay.
I wasn't even going to go there.
And he just said, you have checklists. And then when you have some downtime, if you're an astronaut, just the way your brain works and the way you think, you're just going to do more checklists or fill in the time with more experiments. Nobody looks out of the window. Nobody appreciates it. If you sent poets, philosophers, writers, artists, you'd get a different sensibility of space, probably easier to communicate to the general public and get everyone else excited.
Because they know how to talk about these things?
Yeah. And I'll give another example because I've met her a few times. Laurie Anderson, a performance artist and musician, she was NASA's first and last artist in residence. And apparently on day one, she went into the administrator at Johnson Space Center, just sat behind his desk and said, "Okay, when do I go up?" And it sort of went downhill from there because they weren't going to send her up, and she didn't go up.
But you did say early on, in the early days of NASA, they thought about sending acrobats into space. They thought about sending contortionists into space and, heaven forbid, women into space, I guess because they were smaller or are smaller generally than men.
They were worried very much early on about the physical stresses of space travel. So the circus performer part was just people who are small, nimble, and agile. And many, many species of animals were sent up in the 50s, right back to the sounding rocket days. So all sorts of creatures, most of whom died in the process, were sent up.
But at the same time, it sort of intrigues me that NASA was thinking about acrobats and contortionists.
Yes.
That it isn't just that sort of black and white, sort of narrow science view.
Right. I think NASA is an interesting entity because it's highly bureaucratic government agency, but there's some quite radical thinkers and visionaries that still live there and work there. And I think, you know, once you get inside the bureaucracy, there's some little bubbles of innovation, entrepreneurial thinking, and radical thinking that go on.
Scott Kelly went up recently, and while there was some interest there, you know, there isn't the sort of enthusiasm perhaps of 50 years ago, and perhaps it is more ho-hum to go into space or to go to the space station, for instance.
Right. And people forget that it is special. It's less than 600 people, I think, that have been into Earth orbit. That's a pretty select club. I think 10 times more have stood on Mount Everest. But it's not far. I mean, if you drove to Boston, that's the same distance. Yeah. You're just driving
to
Boston.
Which I didn't realize.
You're just driving to Boston straight up. It's not really a big deal when you say it that way. So that's just hugging the Earth. I mean, it's incredible if you did it. I mean, zero gravity would be amazing. The view, the blackness of space, the thin limb of the Earth's atmosphere would all be amazing. But it's not really leaving your backyard in terms of space.
You also talk about, and this goes into the sort of what it is to be a human being, is that we have this almost built-in need or desire to travel, to explore.
Right. Alone amongst the species of the planet, many of whom do migrate in search of food and resources, we sort of move large distances because we want to. We don't have to. And when humans spread over the world after leaving Africa, it took hundreds of generations, but actually not very long time, to go across Asia, down through the Americas to Patagonia. And it's an extraordinary journeys for nomads, hunter-gatherers, who didn't need to do that just for food or survival. So it seems built into us. And there's tentative research identifying a variant of one gene that correlates with nomadic behavior, large journeys, and also correlates with sort of risk-taking behavior, also ADHD and other things.
Oh, interesting. I mean, are you saying it's built into our DNA, or it's kind of buried in our DNA?
It's a variant of a gene that we all have that's present in 7 to 10% of the population, and it appears strongly in people who have those behaviors. And I guess you can argue that if humans had that gene all the time, you know, that if the risk-taking dominated, we might not have survived. So you can't handle having too many with this gene.
Well, it certainly is risky to go into space. I mean, space is a very inhospitable place. Mm-hmm. I mean, while we might travel the Earth looking for whatever, space is a place where we really can't exist on our own.
Right. It's an unnatural place. And I think that leads some people to reasonably question, you know, why do we even want to go there, explore there, travel there, have colonies there? So again, it gets to the exploration aspect. Right. People, there's no reason to go to the North or South Poles or climb high mountains where the air is thin. So people are doing it for various reasons to test themselves, to see how we might live elsewhere. But you're right, it's very inhospitable. There's high-energy radiation, micrometeorites. I mean, there's all sorts of hazards in space that you don't experience on the Earth.
Why do we need humans in space, though, from your perspective?
So I think there's multiple reasons. I mean, one is that we have very clever robots, and I do think that the robotic exploration of space is always going to be cheaper and, in a sense, better because they're impervious to these vicissitudes of space. They can handle it.
They don't need water, for instance.
Right. They don't need water. They don't need air. They don't need recreation and exercise and so on. So robots will always be important, and they may do the most extraordinary things. But it's our destiny to explore, and if it's built into us, then some fraction of us will always want to do that. And the prospect of being the first off-Earth colonists, I mean, it excites a lot of people.
Including you, I know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, you know, to be honest, I don't think Mars One, you know, has it all worked out to do what they claim they're going to do. But the fact that they got 100,000 people willing to sign up for a death warrant, a one-way trip to Mars, is an indication of something.
Well, which is interesting to think about tourism and space travel. Mm-hmm. 50 years ago, of course, that wasn't even part of our thinking. Mm-hmm. Do you see that as one of the sort of drivers of this need, this desire to explore space?
It's going to be a big business entity. So we've just experienced, you know, less than a dozen space tourists paying tens of millions of dollars, mostly to the Russians, to go to Soyuz. And that's a very rarefied air of tourism. Richard Branson is charging $250,000 for a suborbital flight. That's not even the drive to Boston up. That's not very far at all. And then when it scales up, you know, you can get a real enterprise. I poll my students when I teach astronomy. I did it just a few weeks ago, 18, 19-year-olds, millennials. And you just ask them, how much would you spend on a once-in-a-lifetime 3-day trip into orbit, assuming it's not super dangerous?
Sure.
And I can project that into an economic model for that cohort. And it projects to $30 to $40 billion a year of revenue, which exceeds Hollywood revenue. So it's a serious industry in projection, and it's just on the cusp of happening.
Does it trouble you that business people are sort of leading the charge for space exploration, government taking maybe a back seat or a side seat?
I think the mixed model makes more sense. And so the analogy I like to use, it's maybe a little stretched, is with the internet. So I think this year or around now is 1995 for the internet, the year that word was coined. And that was the year companies that no one had heard of, like Amazon and eBay and Yahoo, were formed. And that was basically the year the internet moved out of the government research domain, and that's the only people who used email back in the 1980s and so on, into the commercial arena, and that sort of never looked back. Mm. So if we are going through an analogous transition in the space industry 10 years from now, it could be unrecognizable.
NASA doesn't get nearly the percentage of federal funding that it used to. In fact, I was surprised to read back in the 60s, you write that the NASA got something like 5% of the federal budget.
Right.
Which is, I mean, today it's
It's 10 times less.
Though. 10 times. But the 5% of the federal budget.
And that's coming back to what you started with, that was a very strange geopolitical time. So you're essentially folding in some part of our defense budget into NASA to fend off the Russians or beat them at this important thing. Because at the time, we had huge numbers of nuclear weapons, and the thought was they would go into space.
Right.
So whoever controlled space was going to control weapons in space. And that was a scary thought. So NASA benefited from that fear factor, and that was anomalous that they were never going to have that budget going forward.
Who are we competing with now, or are we competing with other countries now?
Very much so. Now we're competing with China. And China, while NASA's budget is stagnant, China's space agency budget's been going up at 10% a year for a decade or so, which is the rate their economy's growing. You know, 10% a year, if you had it in your money fund, you'd be very happy. Mm. So their space program is going gangbusters. They have plans for the moon, for Mars, for their own space station. They are touting their taikonauts, as they call them, the version of a cosmonaut or an astronaut. And it's a very aggressive space program.
And are they looking to do what other countries are looking to do, which is to sort of see how far you can go and see what's out there?
Yes. They have multiple motives, not all of which are clear. I mean, they are developing their own technologies as well. They're not just copycatting ours or the Russians. And clearly for the Chinese, it's a projection of their power to be in the space. It's a statement for them. And India is going...
Status, I guess.
Status.
Too.
India is going into space. Japanese are getting more active. So there are more players now than there used to be.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Chris Impey. We've had him on Radio Times a couple of times, and he has a new book. It's called Beyond, subtitled Our Future in Space, and he's also the author more recently of another book called Humble Before the Void, and it is about teaching science to Tibetan monks, and I hope to be able to talk about that a little bit later on in the show. In the meantime, we're going to be talking more about the future of space travel. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Questions or comments to join the conversation, and do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with astronomer Chris Impey about what he describes as a new era of space travel. Let's talk about some of the things that I guess are in the works, on the books, have been talked about for some time, including space elevators. What is that?
Right. So space elevator is a sort of science fiction visionary concept where you basically string a cable into space to the point where it's suspended in air by the centrifugal force on it because the Earth is spinning. So this cable has to go 100,000 kilometers straight up. And
what is 100,000 kilometers? What is that in terms of miles?
That's 60,000 miles.
Okay, 60,000. Okay.
Really far. Like
okay.
Several Earth radii up. And in principle, if you take it to the geostationary point where a satellite would remain directly overhead, then it will suspend itself. But you need a material that can handle the incredible tension of that much weight and that much distance. And no known material, some carbon nanotube composites get close, but they don't manage it. And the point of having a space elevator is that you get over this brutal calculus of the cost of launching something. I mean, people realize that the Saturn V rocket was this incredible thing. It's bigger than the Statue of Liberty. But 95% of it was fuel that you just had to burn to get those three astronauts in that little capsule into Earth orbit. It's incredibly expensive and inefficient. Right. So if you can build a space elevator, then you just put crawlers on the cable and you just go up and down with solar power for free, basically. So it's just the cost of the cable.
I'm thinking about the crawlers. I mean, just that, you know, that we have this on Earth,
yeah,
yes?
Yeah, exactly. So the technologies are not radical. They're not bizarre. But it all depends on this material, this magical mm-hmm. material that is strong enough to do this, Kevlar or something like that. It's got to be light and strong. So for an Earth-based elevator, we can't do it. But for the moon, which has one-sixth of the gravity, our current materials could do it. Wow. So the thinking now, while we wait for an Earth-based space elevator, is that the moon now becomes a much more interesting destination in space, because if you built a base there, and it's not too far, we know we can get there, we've been there before, you can mine the lunar soil for both water and oxygen. With water and oxygen, you can survive, and with the oxygen, you can make rocket fuel, adding hydrogen. And then with a space elevator on the moon, you've got a staging point to anywhere in the solar system really cheap, so you generate a huge potential economic activity.
So how close to something like this are we, and where did this idea first originate?
This first originated from a Russian visionary called Tsiolkovsky 100 years ago.
Really?
I mean, he imagined extending the Eiffel. The Eiffel Tower was being built, and he just looked at the Eiffel Tower as it was being built and thought, let's just take that up further. And, of course, 100 years ago, no chance of doing it, and then it went into science fiction world, and Arthur C. Clarke wrote about it, and he famously was asked, when are we going to get a space elevator? And he said, 50 years after people stopped laughing. Well,
people
have stopped laughing now. And so, you know, we could do it, and I think the cost may only be a few billion, $4 or $5 billion in 10 years on the moon, but not on the Earth. The Earth, we need some new technologies.
And obviously what it's made out of is the most critical thing. What about, you know, meteorites, space junk? I mean, things hitting this space elevator.
Yeah, the space elevator has hazards. Actually, some of the more interesting technical papers allude to one of the biggest hazards is it's such a huge, long stretch cable that instabilities and oscillations become one of the biggest issues. You have to damp out these things. So, you know, there are all sorts of technical issues. Engineers love this stuff because there's so many problems to solve to build a space elevator. But there are other things happening sort of right under our nose that are transforming the economics of space. And one of them is the miniaturization, these little CubeSats that you've probably heard about. They were just it was a spec where in something the size of a Rubik's Cube, you have all the components you need for a miniature satellite. And so that's busted the economics of satellite building, because student groups can do this. You can put bunches of them together to do sophisticated things. So I think last year 140 or so CubeSats were launched, which is more than all the previous years. And so people are miniaturizing space technologies, and that's opening it up to a lot of new players.
What are solar sails? I mean, it's sort of – I can imagine them just – by what they're called.
So solar sail, another venerable idea where you just make some gossamer thin substance like mylar, and you stretch it out, maybe a square kilometer of this, and you just get sun's radiation to propel you. And solar sail has a big advantage and a big disadvantage. The big advantage is it's free energy. The disadvantage is it's a gentle, steady push. So you don't accelerate with a big impulse like a rocket. It just gives you a steady, slow acceleration. But if you're patient, it's not really good for humans traveling around. But for payloads, it's great. The other problem is you can't leave the solar system, because once you're too far from the sun, you don't. But you could, if you could get up to a high enough speed with a solar sail, you could then coast and then use the sun, the next star you reached, to decelerate. So
I'm thinking about Scott Kelly, but also the idea of human beings going deeper into space, a formidable environment. I mean, we've talked about food and water, fuel, things like that. What's on the drawing board for humans going into deeper into space?
So, I mean, the moon we know we could do, and it's only a week to get there. So, you know, you have an escape clause. Mars is tough, and that's, of course, the challenge. Right. Mars One is a private enterprise out of the Netherlands that is claiming that it'll set up a colony in about 12 or 13 years. But most people think they just don't have the wherewithal to do that technically. And the financial model based on reality shows seems a little flaky to a lot of people. NASA's backed off to maybe 15 or 20 years before humans go and spend significant time there. I mean, most people think it will happen. The challenge, of course, is a long deep space journey, maybe 8 or 9 months, subject to a lot of radiation. You will have a lifetime's worth of radiation dose in that 8 months, basically.
There's no way to protect from that?
Because, no, for the same unfortunate logic of space travel, that you could bulk up a spacecraft with hardening, but it makes it heavy and makes it expensive to launch, so it's a trade-off.
Is that why we need robots? I mean, just sort of be our pals in space?
And that's why we need robots. But if you can get to Mars and just handle that at little radiation dose, there are some technologies NASA's demonstrated that take the lunar soil or the Martian soil and make slump block out of it just with electrical energy locally. And then so you can make a hardened environment that's quite safe on Mars or the moon. I mean, we could build a habitat there quite comfortably. It's not very sophisticated technology even.
Including not just protecting us from radiation, but also having air that we can breathe?
Sure, because Martian soil and lunar soil contain oxygen that, again, electrically you can liberate. And then the oxygen you combine with hydrogen to make rocket fuel, so that gets you off those places. You don't have to bring all your fuel with you either to come back. Oxygen and water is all you need, and they're on both places.
What are the psychological impacts, you think? I mean, in many ways, astronauts that have come back from space talk about this transcendent experience if they do look out the window,
right?
Which it's hard to imagine that they wouldn't do that. But what about the sort of psychological effects of being out there?
I think it's profound, and people probably underestimate that as a challenge, to be so dislocated from the Earth that it's just a little dot out of the window of your Martian habitat, and that you know that you can't just get back there.
Right.
So that's a big deal. I think the statistics are that in situations like in Antarctic stations or astronauts in space or whatever, about 10% of the people have profound psychological problems or transcendental experience. I'm not going to put those in the same bucket, but they're altered in ways that sometimes stop them performing or doing their jobs.
And of course, kind of a breakdown of some sort.
And the social aspects of being in a small – well, we know the biosphere example just up the road from where I work was not a happy example. It wasn't a great scientific experiment, but it was also a sign of disharmony amongst the 8 people who were handpicked for that to be inside for 2 years at their own devices.
So you have to pick the right people to be able to live with other people in such intimate quarters.
And I don't think our psychological profiling is quite reliable enough to know what you're going to get.
Let me reintroduce you, and that's Chris Impey, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's an astronomer at the University of Arizona, and he's written several books, and the newest one, the most recent one, called Beyond Our Future in Space. And you can join the conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read an email from Sandy. I'm sure you're used to this. Why do countries, including the United States, want space travel? It's a barren place. It's not interesting. There's nothing to do.
You're right. There's not a lot to do yet. So I think the reason countries want it is often for reasons of power, projecting power, because – but actually a lot of it is practical and is of interest to us. A big part of NASA's budget is now putting things in orbit to look after the Earth, basically to monitor our environment, our climate, our land usage. Sophistication of the technology that we can put into Earth orbit is really benefiting our planet. And so NASA has a lot of inward-looking stuff. So, and then the other part, of course, is we are competing with other nations in the space arena as we do on the geopolitical arena on Earth. And so it's a projection of power.
Are we also looking for, resources, perhaps scarce resources that are are disappearing on the planet, looking in space to replace that?
I think people talk about that, mining asteroids. I mean, I'm sure I mentioned mining asteroids a bit. That most people think that's not plausible in the next couple of decades, that we're not so short on some rare earths or resources that we're quite worried about, and sometimes they're in countries where we don't have good relations. You can get a lot of rare earths and precious metals off of an asteroid. So probably eventually some entrepreneur will just have enough resources to go and lasso an asteroid, bring it into Earth orbit and start mining it and altering world markets and all these materials. So the resources are substantial out there.
You write about something called telepresence, which I guess is sort of the faux experience of being in space. But what is that about, and why is that important?
I think telepresence is important because it allows you to have the best of the both worlds. So we talked about, you know, the directness of being in space and what a rare experience and special that is for a human. And then the fact that robots sort of do it better and cheaper. So telepresence is a way of having your cake and eating it, because you essentially put enough sensory capability in a robot that the human has a "you are there" type experience, because you're giving them a real-time visual sense. You can't really smell in space, but you'll be able to touch. So you would have projective robotic capabilities that would allow a robot to pick up rocks and explore things and do what a human might do, and sort of a full extension of that idea is on the cards, because we already do that in our video games.
I was just thinking about that.
Yeah, so we do it in the terrestrial world of recreation, and it's not hard to do it in space. The catch, however, is light travel time. So it takes radiation, the signals for the robot, 20 minutes to get to Mars, between 15 and 30 minutes depending on Mars distance. So you've got this sort of time lag problem. It's not like a video game. In a video game, if your latency was the second, you'd be really annoyed.
Yeah. Yes.
But now you've got a latency that's 10 or 20 minutes. So that changes the dynamic a little.
I'm imagining in the future, you know, an astronaut's taking off, going to Mars. You're saying maybe 7, 8, 9 months. What are they? I mean, are they in a capsule being shot up there? What is the time like for them? What are they doing?
I think they're not able to do very much, because this is a small capsule. I mean, it's not as cramped. The Apollo capsule, of course, you had very little room. I mean, you could get out of your seat. The space station these things are not going to be like the space station. So
this is pretty roomy, right?
They're going to be small. So basically, it'll be just the place where you sit, and then a small exercise area where you're just probably harnessed into a machine so your muscles don't atrophy. It's not going to be, you know.
Would you want to do that?
I think I wouldn't, actually. So I would love to go into Earth orbit. I think zero gravity, although we talked about 10% of people having problems, 10% of astronauts get severely space sick with zero gravity, and it doesn't matter how well you're trained. So a lot of people who think they might want to go into space might really be uncomfortable there. And I would love to try zero gravity. But signing up for Mars, I'm not one of those 100,000.
No. You want someone else to do it, right?
Yeah. And the one-way trip, I'm not quite ready for a one-way trip yet.
What would you want? Scott Kelly's going to be back in about a year. Mm-hmm. What would you like to ask him? What would you want to know from him? And I know NASA's going to be debriefing him. He actually has a twin brother who's on the planet Gabby Gifford's husband.
That's
so
right.
They'll be able to compare and contrast, I guess, these very closely related siblings.
It's a classic twin experiment. I mean, it's a sample of one, though, so it's tricky to draw conclusions. Yeah. I would love to ask him, in that duration, and now a Russian cosmonaut's been up for 800 days, I think, so over 2 years, that's the record. But I would just want to know, after the first week or so, you know, after the first month or so, how did his thinking change? You know, how did he think about his family and the distant politics and turmoil of the Earth? And you know, did he have any sort of slow evolution in his thinking about regular things? Because that's sort of what a colonist would go through as they dislocate from their home planet. They start to see everything differently. It sort of presumably changes who you are in some profound way. And he and his brother, who are extremely competitive, I noticed from interviews with them, will undoubtedly compare notes.
But you'd be more interested in some philosophical questions rather than, you know.
Yes, because if I'm
losing body mass,
right,
or bone mass,
and those
or
things will happen. These people will be poked and prodded and tested. But the thing I'm interested in the sort of projective part of the book, say, is what happens when we live off Earth? What happens when we have first true humans that are born and die off Earth? At some point, they become a different species. I mean, really playing that forward, they might get to the point where they can't reproduce with us, and they are a new species by a formal definition. But before that, they'll probably become psychologically distinct. And what is that going to look like? What will those people be after 100 years or 1,000 years?
You even tried to extrapolate how many people would you need in space to avoid the problems of inbreeding, right?
Yeah, the population geneticists have weighed in on this, and it's a fairly well-determined number. It's like 120 or 130, getting very carefully selected to make a genetic balance that would not lead to any serious genetic problems. But now, however, you're in space, so your mutation rate's going to go up because of all the cosmic rays, so you probably will have some genetic problems anyway.
Are people really thinking about, I mean, I had never thought about having babies in space, especially with no gravity. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know how that would exactly work.
Well, I'll just hazard a guess that in the emerging commercial space business, there are going to be hotels, sex motels in space, whatever. I can just imagine there's going to be a great battle to have the first baby born in Earth orbit once there are commercial opportunities to be up there for more than a few weeks. So I think it'll happen thanks to the commercial sector.
Well, and we're almost up on a break here, but if the internet is any guide, which is about 40% pornography, that tells you something about what might happen in outer space.
It's going to be a wild west out there.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with astronomer Chris Impey about his new book. It's called Beyond Our Future in Space, and he's a professor at the University of Arizona, and we've been talking about the future of space travel. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with astronomer Chris Impey. He believes we're entering a new era of space exploration because of advances in technology are making space travel to distant planets closer to a reality for human beings. He says innovations, and we've been talking about things like moon elevators and solar sails allowing us to venture out into the unknown. He's a distinguished professor at the University of Arizona, also believing that our impulse to explore is fundamental to who we are. He's the author of a new book called Beyond Our Future in Space. And you can join our conversation. We'd like to know what you think about what we've been talking about. Do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 and send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let's talk about SETI that you write about in the book, the search for extraterrestrial
intelligence. Yeah.
And this has been going on for couple of decades now. What have they found? What have they heard?
Zip. Nada. Zilch. It's called the Great Silence. After 55 years, nothing. And the reason it's interesting and the connection to space travel is that, you know, we're a species that is in the process of venturing off the Earth for the first time. And since Kepler, the NASA mission, has basically put a number on the habitable worlds in the Milky Way, and it's 20 billion. So there are 20 billion biological potential experiments in the galaxy and a lot of billions of years for things to happen. So it's very hard to imagine we're the first to do this.
Right.
And so SETI is the premise that somewhere out there, there are other, not just life forms, but intelligent life forms with technology that have ventured off Earth or have the capability to communicate in space. And so they're trying to listen for those communications.
But does nothing mean nothing? I mean, does a great silence mean nothing? Or we don't know what we're listening for?
That, unfortunately not. There's this aphorism, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So nothing just means nothing. And of course, you can easily imagine that our technology is transient. So we're listening for radio signals and for looking for pulse lasers and so on. And people, you know, intelligent advanced aliens might say, that's so 21st century. You know, we should be using gravity waves. We should be doing something that we just don't know how to do, or neutrinos or something. So you use the technology that you have available, and that will change. So that's one problem. And the other is just space is huge. So the nearest intelligent civilization may be hundreds or thousands of light years away, and that means their signals will be very faint and hard to find.
Do you think there are advanced aliens? I mean, just even mathematically?
I think mathematically it seems likely. It's, you know, if you've got 20 billion biological experiments where all the ingredients are there for life, and it's hard to imagine there's not life on a good fraction of 20 billion worlds. That's a lot of starting point. Now, some biologists will say, well, most species on the Earth, tens of millions, didn't become intelligent. Only one, us, got technology. Unfortunately, you can't make a scientific argument from a sample of one. So biologists actually and physicists sort of argue in opposite directions. Biologists tend to think we're a little special, that there's a lot of flukes or contingency in our evolution to this point. And astronomers just look at those huge numbers and say, hey, it's got to have happened elsewhere. Yeah.
And it is – I mean, it does raise philosophical questions. If we are totally alone, that mm-hmm. raises one set of questions. And if we're sharing the universe, that raises a whole other set of questions.
That's right. If we're just a fluke, then we have to accommodate that into our thinking.
We better behave ourselves,
I think. Yeah, we have a pretty good opinion of ourselves. But if we're a fluke, that sort of puts it in a different light. And if we're not alone, of course, that's profound. It'll affect, you know, world religions. It'll affect our view of ourselves. It could be threatening. People like Stephen Hawking have said we shouldn't be doing the communication experiment. Most of the SETI is listening for signals, yes. But there's a few that are communicating. And he says we shouldn't do that. We're too immature. And because of this timing argument, any civilization we meet is likely to be more advanced. And he suggests maybe not well disposed to us, or why should we take the risk? And so some very prominent scientists, him included, have said, no, we shouldn't do this experiment right now until we get our act together a bit better.
Yeah. I do want to get some callers in, but I do want to ask you about the work that you've been doing teaching science to Tibetan monks, including what, the Dalai Lama? I know the Dalai Lama has an interest in science.
Yes, he's kickstarted a program in 2000, actually, because he's worried about the Tibetan culture becoming like a museum piece, and also the monastic tradition of Tibetan Buddhism is very venerable, old, and the Dalai Lama has scientific leanings. He said he would have been an engineer if he hadn't been picked to be the 14th reincarnation of the Bodhisattva of Compassion at age 4. So he wants his monks to learn science and math and be part of the 21st century. So he started some programs, and a handful of Western educators go out every year to the roof of the world, and not to Tibet, actually. These are the monks in exile in northern India, and it's an amazing experience.
I mean, what do they want to know? I mean, and since you teach students at the University of Arizona, how different are those classes?
Oh, they're amazingly different. I mean, I don't want to diss my students in Arizona. I'm familiar with them, and I'm teaching them right now. The monks are extraordinary because they're sort of fearless in their approach to knowledge. They're a little naive. They're technically naive. Their math level skills are only 8th or 9th grade, but they ask really profound questions.
Such as?
Well, you know, I'll be talking about how we measure the age of the universe to be 13.8 billion years and the various methods. And one of them will just say, well, what is this thing time that you're measuring? Or you use atoms to measure time, radioactive decay. What was the age of the universe before there were atoms? How do you even know?
That's great, though.
So they sort of hop directly to the most profound or basic question, which as a teacher you love. Actually, it can be a little infuriating because you don't have an answer.
Oh, which is – and are you a Buddhist by any chance?
No, I'm not. And actually the person who invited me first, he said – you know, he was a little humorous, but he said, well, we don't really want Buddhist wannabes. We want people who approach the dialogue fresh and without a preconception as to what Buddhism is. And once you get there, you find that the Tibetan Buddhists have this slightly amused view of Western Buddhists when they come out.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
They're the better Buddhists? Are they competitive Buddhists?
They're just amused. they're not very competitive. They just are very amused by how Western Buddhists think about things.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Paul from Newtown Square. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, yes. Good morning, Marty.
Morning.
As usual, I just got back from England, so I've missed you for 2 weeks.
Oh, well, welcome back.
One of the things I did was read galleys for a book, which we're going to publish, called The Astronaut from Bear Creek. And the premise, one of the main characters, this guy's been an astronaut. He's come back, and he's uh, he's become really quite the recluse, kind of holed himself up in a family inn. And it's, you know, first of all, I wonder, does this happen a lot? Is that part of the, you know, the psychology of astronauts? Do many of them actually turn out not wanting to be around people that much? They're also under incredibly difficult. I think back to Chuck Yeager and all the test pilots, the guys who really put their lives on the line, and how today we're kind of averse to danger, and whether that's hurt our aversion to in exploration to go out there and risk people's lives. Seems all the guys who do it are perfectly willing to risk their lives, but we don't like seeing people die. You know, we saw the horrible Challenger.
Sure.
So it makes you wonder about, you know, are we willing to go out in space and, you know, risk discovery like that? And what does it do to these people that come back?
No, Paul, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Go ahead.
I think the studies of astronauts, the psychological profiling or testing, it has shown both before and then downstream after they've been in space that for 10% of them, it was a, you know, a almost sometimes shattering experience. And they are very competitive by nature. I mean, the classic cohort, the early astronauts, were very much a monoculture, in fact, test pilots mostly from the Midwest. I mean, you know, very sort of conventional, staunch people. And they've not really broadened that too much. When the commercial space program gets really going, the demographic is going to shift and broaden quite substantially. So I think the benefit of the astronauts being from a very strict and military and competitive culture is they were ready for these hardships. They were all, for example, when the NASA administrator declared there would be no final servicing of the Hubble Space Telescope, it was because of the danger to the astronauts. And the astronauts essentially bombarded him with emails and calls saying, no, we signed on for the risk. We know we could die. No problem. That's what we did this for. We know. And so they're very clear-eyed about the risk and the danger. And, of course, when the activity broadens, there are going to be people who will die, and they may not have been signing on. They may not have known exactly what they sign on for. So the FAA has had to expand their rules to cover suborbital flight, like the things Branson is doing. But the risk, the waiver, the nature of the waiver you sign is going to be very interesting reading.
Right. Paul, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I mean, it is interesting to compare the kind of preparation that an astronaut has, even just to go to the space station, and what a tourist would do, you know, to prepare. I mean, it just seems to me there would be no comparison between the two in terms of their mental and physical agility.
Right. There is no comparison. I mean, I've been to the Johnson Space Center. I've taught there and lectured there, and I've not ridden the centrifuge, but I've seen this ridiculous centrifuge they put the astronauts in to take them up to 20 Gs, which is
that almost, the Vomit Comet?
No, the Vomit Comet is another thing, and that's just a few seconds of zero gravity. This is a fairground ride that spins you to a crazy level of Gs, and so all sorts of training. Yes, they go through the mill. And of course, we sometimes forget that most of the astronauts who went through that rigorous training never flew. There's only a subset that flew. Yes, the space tourists will have some training, but to be honest, what I've read about Virgin Galactic and the others is the training is part of the enhancement of the experience. It's part of making you feel really special. A really good example is it's debatable whether a Virgin Galactic will use spacesuits with helmets, because having helmets creates a problem in that environment. But of course, not having helmets means if there's a depressurization, you know, that's it. It's all over.
Sure.
At the moment, I don't think they're going to have spacesuits and helmets, and so people, you know, are going to be just in that thin sheet of metal away from the vacuum of space.
Sounds like Richard Branson to me, right? Let me get Jeff from Princeton to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, great. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So the biologist versus astronomer piece you talked about earlier sort of raised a pet peeve of mine. And I should say I'm a big science fiction fan. I would love for there to be aliens. But when you look at the overwhelming amount of species that have been on Earth that have not been intelligent, it just strikes me as mathematically impossible for there to be intelligent life close enough to Earth for us to have any meaningful relationship with them. And what strikes me as the key irony here is a lot of folks talking about aliens are secularists who make fun of intelligent design, but they seem to actually have their own teleology in the sense that, well, of course, wildlife is just going to wind up being intelligent, and if there's life, it's going to be intelligent, which is precisely what intelligent design people talk about, that they make fun of.
Yeah, it's interesting, Jeff. Thanks for the call. Go ahead, Chris.
So, yeah, that's a good point, and I agree with you. Operationally, there's a magic number of about 3,000 light years, because if civilizations in their ability to travel or communicate in space only last 3,000 years, then they're going to be isolated in space and time. So I agree. It's unlikely there's any such putative civilization within hundreds, maybe even thousands of light years. As far as intelligence goes, that's tricky too, because, you know, I presume and think that dolphins and some marine mammals are fairly intelligent, possibly sentient. But they're never going to have telescopes and travel in space, and they just don't have opposable thumbs. So you're right. It was a particular outcome of evolution on this planet. But I think we have to sort of be agnostic about it. We can't declare it sort of extremely unlikely to impossible or very likely, and it happened everywhere. It did happen here. It took a long time. That's true. But remember, we now know the material existed for Earth clones to exist that had a head start on the Earth by 8 billion years. So the issue of time is not a big deal. The universe provides a lot of time and a lot of real estate.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We have an email from John. He wants to know, is it possible that space exploration may take the place of war? I mean, if it's instead of – I'm not sure if he means war in space or just that the competition in space might replace what's happening on Earth.
It's a good question, because I think it is possible. I mean, I imagine that we'll see the continuing emergence of the commercial space sector, and we've talked about NASA's budget doldrums. But I would almost guarantee that if China develops a concrete, tangible plan for a moon base with a date when they're going to do it, we'll be back there. Uh-huh. So the geopolitical angle is very strong. And the United States, nor any large world power, nobody wants to cede space. Now, the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, you know, bans the militarization of space, says you cannot own the moon or Mars or asteroids or whatever. But it's sort of unenforceable, and it's never been tested. And so, you know, given that the world is still a geopolitically competitive place, space could well be the next arena. And the prospect of weapons out there is extremely scary. We got very agitated a few years ago when the Chinese destroyed one of their own satellites in a sort of Star Wars missile sense, and of course created a huge amount of space debris, which was annoying to everyone. But it was also a symbol of how things could get twitchy.
We're going to end on that note. Twitchy. Chris Impey, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio
it's
Times.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
A pleasure for us as well. The book is called Beyond Our Future in Space. He's University Distinguished Professor, Deputy Head of the Department of Astronomy at the University of Arizona. The book is called, as I said, Beyond. Also the author of How It Begins, How It Ends, and Humble Before the Void, and that's about teaching science to Tibetan monks. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. We're going to close things out with Fly Me to the Moon. This is Frank Sinatra, Count Basie singing the Bart Howard classic. Let's listen.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars. In other words, kiss me, fill my heart with song, let me sing forevermore. You are all I long for, all I worship and adore. In other words, please be true. In other words,